This is Richard Verone, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Wilfred Marshall. Mr. Marshall, you are in San Jose, California. I am in Lubbock, Texas, at Texas Tech University in the Special Collections Library. And it is January 3rd, 2003, and the time is about 11:06 Pacific Standard Time, 1:06 Central Standard Time. Mr. Marshall, if we could, let's start with some basic biographical information on yourself. Tell me when you were born and where you were born.
I was born September 15th, 1944, in LaGrange, Georgia.
Okay. Whereabouts in Georgia is that?
It's about 75 miles southwest of Atlanta.
Okay. Okay. And did you grow up there in LaGrange?
I spent a couple of years there. I lived mainly in Georgia until I was about 16 years old.
Okay.
And we moved to California.
What are your memories of your time there, those first 16 years in Georgia?
Well, it's a lot different than California. I was an outdoors-type kid. Did spend a lot of time in the woods, fishing, camping. Mm-hmm. Spent a lot of time with my grandparents in LaGrange, Georgia. And I had a very normal, uneventful childhood, basically.
Okay.
Pleasant, safe 50s.
How many siblings did you have?
I have two brothers and a sister.
Okay, and what, were you one of the, in the middle? Or
I'm the oldest.
You're the oldest.
Yeah.
Okay. So what did your parents do for a living?
Well, my mother, despite graduating tops in her class, never went to college. She worked during World War II to support my father, who went to the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
He got a Bachelor's of Science in Chemistry at Mercer University in Macon, Georgia,
mm-hmm.
and subsequently got a Master's degree in Engineering at Georgia Tech.
Okay.
And he worked for Martin Marietta in Towson, Maryland for a while, and then mm-hmm. came back to Georgia Tech to work for quite a few years in the electronics labs.
Okay. And your mother stayed at home?
Yeah, she stayed at home and helped raise the family, and she also worked part-time as a secretary and office assistant.
Okay. Okay. Was your father's naval experience a really big influence on you? Do you remember him being in the Navy?
No, I have no memory of that at all. It was no influence at all.
Okay. What kind of jobs did you work while you were young?
Nothing particular. I was, like I said, I lived in Georgia until I was just 16 years
right.
old, so I had little work experience.
Okay, okay. And when you were 16, where did you guys move?
We moved to Sunnyvale, California. My father got a position with Stanford Electronics Labs in Palo Alto, Stanford University.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and how long did you stay there? Was that...
Were still
you,
here.
Okay, okay. You stayed in California.
Yep.
All right.
Still there. Same house.
Tell me about your high school years. What do you remember most about high school?
It was kind of a disjointed experience for me. I went to three different high schools and didn't have a rather consistent experience in terms of curriculum. It was kind of awkward changing schools several times. Coming to California, it was kind of a curiosity. I have a southern accent and didn't really fit into the scene out here that well, but I adapted like all good southern boys can do.
Right.
So nothing really spectacular. I had good to average grades and on the cross country and track teams, but nothing spectacular.
Were you a good student academically?
Yeah, I was pretty good. A's and B's mainly.
What were your favorite subjects?
I enjoyed history and science and creative writing.
Okay. Okay. So you were on the track team. Any other sports?
Track and cross country.
Cross country. Okay. You didn't play basketball, football, anything like that?
No, I made the basketball team one year, but the day after I made it, I broke my wrist. So kind of short-circuited that career.
Right, right. Okay. Did you have aspirations to go to college? Was it expected for you
to
go
definitely.
To college?
I was expected to go to Stanford. It didn't quite work out.
Uh-huh.
Didn't have the grades, and that was partially a result of my moving around a lot and, uh-huh. again, having kind of a disjointed experience.
Mm-hmm.
But, I plan to go to college from early on.
Okay. Where did you end up going?
I went to Foothill Junior College in Los Altos Hills, California
mm-hmm.
for 2 years, and then I transferred to San Jose State.
Okay. What was your experience like at Foothill?
Well, it was just college prep, basic education, undergraduate stuff, got all that out of the way
mm-hmm.
before transferring. That was the beginnings of the Vietnam experience. I remember standing out in front of a teletype machine when President Kennedy was assassinated, and I was walking past the journalism building, and the teletype started ringing, and I stopped and looked at it and sat there you know, just awestruck watching the events being printed out there in front of me on the teletype machine. That's my one big memory from that, from college in those days.
Wow. What year did you actually enter college?
1962.
Okay. And you graduated in 66?
No, I didn't graduate until 69 because the Army took some time out of my life.
Okay. So tell me, that was your memory of Kennedy. Was that at Foothill?
Yeah, that was pretty riveting.
Yeah. Were you still interested in history when you got there to college?
Yes, I was an English major at the time. Mm-hmm. Well, I was planning on being an English major at the time, but I was also a history minor. So those are my two favorite subjects.
Did you find yourself a decent student in college? Or?
Yeah, I was pretty good. I had my first year was kind of rocky, but I was pretty much straight A's after that.
Mm-hmm. Did you play any sports?
Not in college, no. I worked full-time also at a discount store while going to college my first 2 years.
Okay. And when you went to San Jose, did you work there?
I worked for 1 year while I was at San Jose State, and one of the reasons I ended up getting almost drafted. I couldn't find enough units to take, and my units dropped down to 12 units. That's when the draft board came calling.
Okay, so you went under full-time hours,
yeah.
Basically. And so
oh, yeah.
As soon as that happened,
yeah.
You got a call.
Yep.
Okay. Well, tell me about that time. This is in 1966?
Yeah, 66.
Okay. How aware were you of U.S. foreign policy, what was happening in Vietnam?
I had kept up with it quite a bit. Since high school, I first became interested in what was happening over there in high school. That wasn't that was 62. Our really heavy involvement hadn't quite begun yet. But it was a current topic of conversation. I was quite familiar with our apparent aims over there. I'd done a little bit of background reading on the Indochina War with the French.
Mm-hmm.
And tried to make myself as conversant as I could what was going on over there, although the media presentations at the time were tended to be more sensational.
Mm-hmm.
And as I recall, our government spokesman, oh, my phone's running out, our government spokesman weren't too forthcoming at the time. So, but it was a little problem here.
Let's pause it here just
my,
for a second.
My telephone.
This is Richard Perrone, and I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Fred Marshall. Today is February 18th, 2003. It's a little after 5 o'clock Central Standard Time. Mr. Marshall is in San Jose, California, and I'm in Lubbock, Texas. Sir, let's pick up where we left off. You had just basically gone under hours at San Jose State in 1966, and the Army came calling, and you had decided to enlist versus getting drafted. Tell me first, before we kind of go into your training, we were talking about what you knew of American policy in Vietnam and what was happening in 1966 in the world. How aware were you, or can you describe what you knew of what the United States was trying to do in Southeast Asia in 66?
I was reasonably aware, I guess, as well as I could be at that time. I understood our need for being there. I thought right from the beginning, though, that the government never really did a very good job of articulating just why we were there. It was rather clear to me, but they seemed to keep changing their point of view from one of victory to one of containment to one of forestalling the inevitable to whatever. But I was generally in agreement with the aims of the government at the time.
Okay. So you didn't have a problem with the policy at the time?
No.
How did your family feel about you enlisting?
Well, they weren't overly happy about it, like I said in my questionnaire, but since I was a legal adult, there wasn't much they could do about it at the time.
Right.
But I tried to explain to them, I'm going to get drafted, so I might as well enlist and be able to choose what I want to do, what training I want to get.
Mm-hmm.
And I told them right off the bat that, as odd as it sounds, I wanted to volunteer to go to Vietnam, but I wanted to get some language training first,
mm-hmm.
which required taking a variety of tests before I even enlisted.
Really?
They weren't too happy. My fiance wasn't too happy about it either, but she understood.
Right. Did you get a sense at the time in the United States that, since the war was on and we were fully engaged in 1966, that young men were expected to make that decision, you know, and to either decide to go or to stay home or to go to Canada or whatever?
Well, a lot of kids went to Canada, including some friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably about the same as before the Civil War when there was similar situations going on, draft riots and everything. Mm-hmm. I had a few friends that that enlisted, and had a few more that got drafted. I had two acquaintances at the time that did go to Canada. It was quite a bit of concern about that, of course. I know a lot of kids stayed in college that didn't really want to be there, taking
right.
courses they didn't really want to take,
mm-hmm.
because that was one of their few options. And I'm sure a few resurrected some old medical problems that might have kept them out. But it was quite a topic of discussion. I was also working full-time at a discount store.
Right.
And all the other guys there who were about my age, they were quite concerned about it. Oddly enough, they never got drafted. They weren't going to school. They were draft age, but for some reason, their numbers just never came up, you know. So that was just kind of a crapshoot. You never knew
right.
what was going to happen from day to day.
Did you decide you just simply didn't want to take that chance and you
yeah,
weren't going to control your destiny?
About a week before final exams in my fall semester, I got a letter from the draft board, and I went to the draft board and said, "Look, you've got me called here right in the middle of a final exam."
Right.
And they said, "Well, not much we can do about it." And I said, "You know, sure there is. Let me take the exam and, you know, call me next time."
Mm-hmm.
And they finally did, and they said, "Well, you know, we'll get you next time." So I finished my finals and went up to the U.S. Army Recruiting Center in Palo Alto and began the enlistment process.
Now, how did you decide that you wanted to do... Well, first of all, you said you volunteered to go to Vietnam. Tell me about that.
Well, I kind of planned it out after I made the decision to enlist.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to the recruiter before I enlisted about exactly what my options were.
Mm-hmm.
And he said with my background and my education at that point, I was only a semester away from graduating,
right?
That I might consider Army Intelligence School.
Okay.
So I had to go to Oakland Army Base to take a test to get into placements, get into intelligence mm-hmm. training, which required I had to be interviewed about world politics and history, and I had to write a long essay and take a test, kind of a multiple choice thing about history and politics and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
military history, and I passed that quite easily. Then I had to go back and take a test for a language training. I'd taken Latin and French and Spanish in high school and college, so I had a pretty good idea. Our languages worked, so I almost aced that test. Then once I had passed those two tests, then I went back and enlisted because I kind of had things planned out at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And as it worked out, things fell into place fairly well after I enlisted. So.
Well, tell me what happened after you enlisted.
Well, I went to basic training at Fort Polk, Louisiana,
okay.
which was a lot of fun.
Was this March 1966?
Yeah, the barbed wire kept the mosquitoes out pretty well, though, there. Then after that, I went to Fort Holabird, Maryland,
mm-hmm.
in Baltimore, U.S. Army Intelligence School.
Okay.
And I was trained in combat intelligence techniques.
Okay.
And then went to Vietnamese Language School at Fort Bliss, Texas, actually Biggs Field Air Force Base next to Fort Bliss,
okay.
for 47 weeks of Vietnamese language training.
Wow.
And I went to Vietnam.
Okay, let's go back to Fort Polk. Tell me about your basic training. What do you remember about that?
I remember it was...
Besides the mosquitoes.
Well, I remember the weather was bitter cold in the morning and hot and sweaty in the afternoon, and I was born in Georgia, so I was a little bit more used to the humidity than
mm-hmm.
a lot of other the Yankee boys that were there.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pretty intense. It was pretty much like I expected it to be. A lot of in-your-face yelling right up front.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, it tends to... One of the goals is, of course, to kind of break down your individuality and
right.
build up your team spirit and camaraderie and kind of an all-for-one and one-for-all thing. And
mm-hmm.
that was very effective. I thought the DIs, they put on a good act. They acted real tough and brutal and mean.
Mm-hmm.
But off-duty, they were just like anybody else, you know. You could get the sense that, you know, this isn't a lot of fun for you or us either. But we need to prepare you for possibly getting killed.
Right.
And we don't want anybody else to get killed because we didn't train you properly and we didn't train you how to use your weapon properly or proper tactics or camouflage or whatever
because
mm-hmm. everybody has to do his job. And they were quite concerned about that. They were. It was kind of odd at graduation. I still recall this big Choctaw Indian drill sergeant whose name I forget. I guess I could find my yearbook and look it up, though. He was almost in tears at that point. You know, you knew a lot of guys were going to Vietnam, and others were going on to advanced infantry training and before they went to Vietnam. And he was almost in tears telling us goodbye, you know, because
really?
He'd been to Vietnam. He knew what it was like. I guess he served at least two tours, as far as I recall. So, you know, the guys there, they had their minds and their hearts in the right place. They weren't just going through the motions. They were really trying to keep guys alive because most of our DIs had been to Vietnam at that point.
What do you remember them telling you about Vietnam?
Just that, oh, boy. Well, they were an infantry unit. So they had some pretty brutal tales to tell, not to the point of shocking and scaring people, but that was kind of unavoidable given the context of what they had to say.
Mm-hmm.
But just that it was quite different. It was a different kind of war, different kind of expectations than anything we've been involved in. That they just worried all the time about who could they trust, where could they go. There being no front line as in a conventional war. And it's just that they had to just be on their toes almost constantly. There was they just couldn't relax. And of course, when I got there, I found out that was entirely true.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like they had prepared you well?
Oh yes, definitely. In basic training, at least in terms of tactics and teamwork and marching and military etiquette and code of justice and weapons training and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, after basic, people that were going into the infantry went on to advanced infantry training at one of several bases,
mm-hmm.
Fort Hood or Fort Leonard Wood and places like Fort Benning,
mm-hmm.
Fort Bragg. But as far as the basic training went, there was no social engineering back then like there is now.
Mm-hmm.
There were no women.
Right.
And standards were very high. And either you cut it or you didn't, and you were encouraged to make the grade. I don't recall any of our guys dropping out. I'm sure it's quite different today from what I've read about current basic training. I'm glad that the people that we have that are being trained today aren't going to have to go into some place like that. I'm not sure they could do it.
Really? Did you adjust personally to that military lifestyle okay, or was it difficult
for
you?
Yeah, I didn't have any real problems with it. I was able to. You have to do a lot of subjugating your own individuality out of necessity,
mm-hmm.
in this
mm-hmm.
situation, of course. And I didn't have any real adjustment problems with it.
Okay, what would you say was the most challenging aspect of your basic?
Giving myself a shot in the leg.
Really?
Yeah, our DI was real competitive, you know, and he'd say. You know, the other company, the other platoon yesterday, they had all but five of their guys give themselves a shot, and we want everybody to do it today, so
mm-hmm.
I wasn't too happy about that. Some of the night hikes weren't a lot of fun. The PT courses, especially as the weather got warmer in late spring, weren't a lot of fun. The general environment, you know, was not a very healthy one, but it was much like Vietnam. It was hot and humid,
mm-hmm.
especially toward the end of our training.
Right.
It was pretty rough. But I was in reasonably good shape at the time. I'd done a lot of track and cross country in high school, and
mm-hmm.
I kept myself in reasonably decent condition. So I managed to survive. In fact, I was our platoon's number one trainee.
Really?
I don't know how that happened, but I still have a little trophy in the basement around here somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Did you find yourself, I mean, was that a leadership position?
I was what they call a platoon guide. I was in charge of our training platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to get everybody out in the morning and lined up and do roll call. And I had to do all the marching around and everything else. And if something happened, no matter what, I got blamed for it. But that's
mm-hmm.
that's military way.
How did you feel being in that leadership position?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
How did you feel being in that leadership position?
It was okay. I was the original guy. Got drunk one about 2 weeks into training and
mm-hmm.
got canned. And I still remember I was squad leader at the time, and I remember the DI coming in and said, well, old Smith here, whatever his name was, he messed up big time. We need a new platoon guide. You, Marshall, come here. You know, it's like the Army way. I need two volunteers, you and you.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it was all right. It was okay because I got a better bet out of it.
Right. Tell me about the weapons training that you had.
We got trained on the M14 at that time,
uh-huh.
which was, you know, a big, heavy thing. And, It was very effective, I thought. I'd never fired a weapon in my life.
Really?
At all, even though I was from the South. You know, everybody's supposed to have pickup trucks with gun racks and everything. Well, you're from Texas, you know that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very effective. If they could take somebody like me, that had no familiarity with weapons whatsoever. And I qualified as an expert marksman. So that's pretty good. And we were, you know, we were told to baby these things, and we learned how to clean them, take them apart, and the whole bit, and carry them safely, you know, the whole thing. And that was the only weapons we had there. We also had training how to throw a grenade that didn't take too long, though. I had further training in Vietnam, kind of on the spur of the moment, different weapons.
Okay. When you did get to Vietnam, did you look back at your basic and say, okay, yeah, they did a good job, but I'm applying this stuff now?
Yeah, I was, in terms of basic discipline, basic unit order and military etiquette and things like that, you know, you felt comfortable within the framework of Vietnam. Of course, the command structure is totally different than in basic, but it made you fit in quite easily.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So after you finish at Fort Polk, you moved to Fort Halliburton in Maryland to the intelligence school. And how did you get selected for the intelligence school?
Well, like I said, I that was my choice. I selected that upon enlistment.
Okay, so
like I said, you had to pass a test to get into there.
Right.
You had a basic intelligence test and some other things. So I qualified for that.
You knew all along this is where you were going.
I had kind of a selfish motive involved. I wanted to get into something that might help me, at least get me a few college units when I got out. And it did. So I didn't have any aversion to going into the infantry. You know, I could have ended up there anyway. But as long as I was going to go in, to reiterate, I just wanted to do something that was more of my choice instead of somebody else's. I mean, make the best of it.
Right, right. So how long were you up in Maryland at Fort Halliburton?
Well, let's see. I got there in March. When did I get there? I don't even remember.
I have here May 66.
Yeah, I guess I was there from May to August.
Okay.
Of 66.
Can you tell me about that training, what you underwent?
Okay. It was combat intelligence training, which was geared toward Vietnam, toward the end of the training. At first, just basically how to find out. What we call order of battle, how different foreign armies structured their military, and then we moved on to how the North Vietnamese structured theirs, and map reading, military terminology, a little practice on interrogation, just basic kind of information that would help you understand the enemy, and since I ended up as an interrogator and an interpreter in Vietnam. This all came in very handy because I could easily make the translation from what I'd learned there in terms of how to ask certain questions of enemy soldiers and what certain types of weapons might mean, and just little hints. It's kind of like a detective.
Right.
Story almost, just kind of like what to be alert for, what to be aware of when trying to build up an order of battle on your enemy, which is just basically a file, a dossier on different enemy units and tactics and whatnot. Just the more you can find out about them, like I think I said somewhere in my questionnaire, the more you know about them, the better chance you have of blowing them up before they get you.
Right.
So it's very effective training overall.
Was it a lot of classroom, or was it...
Yeah, it was mainly classroom stuff with a few field activities thrown in, but it was mainly just classroom training.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tell me about what you think was the most effective. Now, I know when you went to Vietnam, you're an advisor, you're an interrogator. What was the most effective thing that you learned there in your advance that you took with you to Vietnam?
Basically, I ended up as an intelligence analyst.
Okay.
And again, just knowing what to ask, knowing what to look for in terms of how the enemy is structured. The North Vietnamese Army is pretty much structured like ours, broken down from division to regiments and brigades and right on down the line. But so just knowing how they were structured and organized, their chain of command, it eventually allowed me to understand their structure and their order of battle, and just to be able to ask intelligent questions of Viet Cong and North Vietnamese prisoners and defectors. Nothing really specific stands out. It's just general background training.
Did they give you history of the country and history of the unit?
Yeah, a little bit. Okay. And some of our instructors were Vietnam veterans at that time, both the enlisted men, some of the NCOs, and the officers. And we got a little bit of background on the conflict there and some history of the country. Of course, it was probably more slanted toward government point of view, which was all right. Mm-hmm. But they did try to bring it to date on what was happening there and why.
Okay. Can you remember anything they were telling you about how to actually interrogate a Vietnamese?
No, I had limited, and we all had kind of a general training in interrogation techniques. There was nothing specific. I just kind of learned on the job.
Okay.
You know, one thing that was helpful was learning how to read maps, especially topographical maps at different scales.
Mm-hmm.
That came in really handy because as part of my job, I ended up being a map maker. Is just kind of an aside in my unit, and but knowing being able to read the maps of Vietnam when we got there, the topographical maps came in very handy for me because it would often help me do some backtracking with a prisoner. You know, when you were coming here, tell me about the land you came through. Did you cross any rivers or see any bridges or mountains or power lines of anything? And sometimes it was helpful to be able to kind of follow the map trail back from where the guy probably came from, and then send in people to check out that area. So the map work came in very handy in that regard.
Okay. And did you know exactly that you were going to Vietnam? I mean, you knew for sure? Or
Not yet.
Okay.
While I was at Fort Holabird, I applied for language school.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd already taken the test. And while I was there, I got my orders to go to language school at Bixfield, Texas.
Now, is this something that they asked you to do, or is this something that you said, well,
no,
I need to be better?
Something I wanted to do.
I
did want to end up in Vietnam, and I figured as long as I was going to be there, let's learn the language.
Right.
Because I knew I was being in an intelligence job, either as an analyst or an interrogator or something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I'm pretty good at learning languages. I have a facility for it. So why not go ahead and do it? Plus, also, eventually got 30 units of college credit out of it. So
wow.
That came in handy.
Sure.
But
sure.
But it made my time in Vietnam much more intense.
Mm-hmm.
and understandable. I got so much more out of the experience because I could speak the language fairly well.
Mm-hmm. How many weeks were you training at?
47 days? Weeks, 7 hours a day.
Wow. So did you become pretty fluent?
At that time, yeah. You had to pass a test at the end of the course, and if you didn't pass it, you didn't get sent to an MOS where you had to use the language.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very well taught. We were taught by a Vietnamese man.
Okay.
Yeah, not by Army personnel.
Okay. I was going to ask you that. So was it your same instructor the entire way through?
Yeah. Trần Văn Bích.
You remember?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. He. We went to his house a couple of times. He had a little apartment there in El Paso.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to be in Vietnam in the Army. And he kept saying, I wish I were there, but the Vietnamese government sent him to the United States because he was fluent in English and Vietnamese. And our government at that time was understandably having a hard time finding any Americans who could speak Vietnamese. So they had to rely on native Vietnamese speakers. But never knew what happened to him. I wrote him for about 6 or 7 months after I left there.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, one of his letters came back, moved and address unknown. So I never knew what happened to the guy.
Right. Did you feel like you received good training?
Oh, yeah. It was very, very good. I don't know. Some of the guys there, I still remember, they could barely speak English.
Okay.
I don't know. They had no hope of ever learning a tricky language like Vietnamese. It's mm-hmm. not Latin or Greek based.
Mm-hmm.
And they just did miserably. Some washed out along the way. Some didn't pass the test. There were two different levels of training. There was a 47-week course and a 37-week course, 36-week course. And there was a shorter course, too, but I don't recall how long that was. But I do remember a lot of people leaving in the middle of training. They just didn't make it. And some of the assignments, I remember one guy in our class was posted, he was a Marine, he got posted to the Swedish embassy in Sweden.
Okay.
That's really intelligent. Another guy was sent to the Fitzsimmons Army Hospital in Denver. So I remember wondering at the time, why did they have to learn Vietnamese to do these things?
This is right out of Bixfield.
right out of there. So
wow.
But all the guys in my class, except this one Marine, we shipped over. Well, two of the guys didn't make it. They didn't pass the course. You had to take an oral test, a tape test, a written test at the end. And if you didn't make the grade, you didn't go.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember two of our guys, they just didn't make it. They didn't work very hard while they were there. So I don't know where they ended up. They didn't go to Vietnam, at least not then.
Is that where you found out at Fort Bliss, Bixfield, that you were going to Vietnam?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, after we spent a year doing that, we better go. Yeah, we got the orders about 2 or 3 weeks before the end of our course, and we had a month leave before we went.
What did you do for your month leave?
I was married at the time, so I got married between language between Fort Oliver and Fort Bliss or Bixfield, and hadn't seen my wife hardly at all. So we just took a few little short trips in California and did little menial things like write a will, you know, this kind of stuff. You know, I was realistic about the whole thing. And so no real memories from that period about anything special I did. I just spent a lot of time with my wife and my family.
How did you feel about going into a combat zone, going to Vietnam?
Well, yes, you know, that's what I asked for, so I didn't have any illusions about what it was going to be like. So I was kind of apprehensive, of course. I don't ever recall really being scared, a little nervous, but I felt that was the best place for me at the time.
What about your wife and your parents?
Well, they weren't overjoyed. My parents were very supportive of government policy at the time, as was I. So, you know, they tended to be outwardly, you know, we're really proud of you, this is great. You know, I'm sure on the inside they were hurting a lot because we knew some people who had lost sons in Vietnam. So I'm sure on the inside they were very nervous about it, but they didn't want to tell me that, of course. You know, they didn't say things like, please don't get killed, you know. I said, I'll try not to. Yeah.
Right, right. Did they back U.S. policy at the time?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. How did you get into Vietnam? Did you fly civilian air over?
We went over on, it was a civilian airliner. I forget the name. It was TWA. Just a big old Boeing 707. And landed at Bien Hoa. And went from there.
What was the airplane ride like over there? What do you remember about that?
Well, it was... You know, it was you're flying into your future. You haven't got a clue what you're doing. There's no sense of camaraderie because we weren't the guys on our plane. They weren't part of a big unit. You know, the big divisions in the units. They all went over together en masse, either usually on ships or in a whole fleet of aircraft, and arrived at their specific division base, like 25th Division or 1st Air Cav or 101st Airborne or whatever. Guys on airplane were just all going over to, you know, a whole number of different units, either MACV units or returning from leave or who knows what. So there was no sense on the plane of, you know, this gung-ho camaraderie that the guys that were in the same unit would have. So I was on the plane with three guys that I had spent the whole time at Bixfield with. In fact, I knew two of them from Fort Hollibert. So we've been together for a long time. But they, after we got there and were sent to our different advisory teams, I didn't see them again until we came back on the same plane.
Really?
A year later, you
wow.
know, and we all looked quite a bit different at that time. We had a lot of things to talk about. But we flew from Oakland, from Travis Air Force Base, not Oakland. We left from Oakland Army Base to Travis Air Force Base, and we flew from there to Alaska, to, I forget, some base in Alaska. And then from there to Kadena Air Force Base in Japan, and then from there on to Bien Hoa, Vietnam.
How did you feel when you arrived in Bien Hoa? What was your first impression of the country?
God, it was hot. It felt like I was back in Fort Polk. We got there at night, in the middle of the night, and we walked across the tarmac into the Quonset Hut terminal there, and we knew we were in a combat zone because you could see flares in the sky and whatnot, a little bit of tracer fire going up in the air or coming down from helicopters off in the distance, and little muffled artillery and mortar rounds in the distance. So right off the bat, you know, we knew we weren't in Kansas anymore.
Right.
I just remembered how hot it was and mm-hmm. how humid it was, because we've been on the air-conditioned plane for a long time, and mm-hmm. it just hits you in the face. Mm-hmm. Like a fist.
What would you say was the morale of the troops around you?
Oh, good. There was no reservations or no griping or whining. You know, everybody's a lot of bravado. You know, mm-hmm. at that time, you know, mm-hmm. we didn't know what it was going to be like. But so everybody's got this kind of a bravado type attitude. Yeah, we're going to kick butt and kill the Viet Cong and everything else. So, right. my whole time there, at least in my little unit and with the other guys I worked with, some other units, I was always impressed with the high level of morale and confidence.
Did you think? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm finished.
Did you think that that was true? I mean, you've been through Vietnamese language training, intelligence training, and you knew probably maybe the country, the culture a little bit better than the average soldier over there, for sure, probably.
A little bit.
Did you feel like it was realistic what they were saying?
Yeah, for the most part, I had no frame of reference to consider otherwise. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think it was sincere.
Okay. Did you still understand? Why did you still have the same feelings as
yeah.
why the United States was there?
Yeah, I had no qualms about it, no reservations about it. To mm-hmm. me, it was no different than Korea.
Okay,
you know, it was an invasion of a fledgling democracy, rather imperfect, of course, by mm-hmm. a totalitarian communistic dictatorship, and mm-hmm. It was very cut and dried to me. I had no illusions about it whatsoever.
Okay, what were the first few days like? What did you do?
Well, they took us all and took us to what was called a replacement depot. And the next morning, they made sure we all had the right uniforms and equipment and everything that we brought with us from the States. And mm-hmm. if we didn't have a certain item, they'd tell us where the PX was. And then my first day was spent shoveling human waste from the latrines and burning it.
Really?
And this was a lot of fun. I was kind of taking guys that are just in the country and they're not acclimated to the climate. And in October, it's hot and dry.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 100 degrees and rather humid, but there's no rain at that time. And you take these guys that aren't acclimated yet, because the people that came in there were from all over the place.
Right.
And we're out there burning human waste in giant iron pots for mm-hmm. our first duty in Vietnam. Yeah, welcome to Vietnam. And a lot uh-huh. of guys just passing out from heat stroke and everything, and nobody really seemed to care, you know, at this point. I just remember finishing that and going to the library, which was just basically an air-conditioned trailer. Didn't want to read. I just wanted to get cool, drink mm-hmm. a lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
We did that for one day. And the next day, me and these three other guys that came with me from Biggs Field, we were taken into Saigon. To a billet there, hotel for enlisted men,
mm-hmm.
and we spent the night there, and then the next day we got up and we went to some installation near Tan Son Nhut mm-hmm. Air Base, which was the headquarters of the 525th MI Group,
mm-hmm.
where we got our orders to go to a specific advisory team.
Okay,
and a couple of days later we split up and. My friends went their separate ways, and I went out to Tan Son Nhut and got on a helicopter with some other guys and flew out to Advisory Team 70 and spent my year there.
Hmm. Tell me what your impressions were of Saigon.
Oh, man, totally chaotic. I'd never been out of the United States before except for some time in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And Saigon, I was surprised by how nonchalant everybody seemed to be. It didn't seem like a war zone at all at the
mm-hmm.
time. It was incredibly busy, heavily commercial, traffic flowing everywhere, zillions of little motorbikes and mopeds everywhere, and the only thing people seemed to know about them is where the accelerator was and the horn was.
Uh-huh.
Just totally chaotic. Didn't feel afraid at all, even though we've been warned, you know. Unfortunately, you can't tell who the enemy is there. It's a different kind of situation. So
mm-hmm.
At first, we were very alert, you know, but people seemed very friendly and open to us, even though everybody's trying to sell you something. And,
mm-hmm.
But it was just a very bustling, busy place, neon flashing and everything, and it didn't really seem like this was the center of a war.
Right.
But at night, we quickly found out the daytime is ours, the nighttime belongs to the other guy, We go up on the roof of this building at night. It's about 6-7 stories tall.
Mm-hmm.
And in every direction, all you can see is flares, helicopters flying over. You know, the war is just right outside the city.
Mm-hmm.
It looked dramatic, but there may have been just some small ambush or something going on, or somebody blowing up a culvert or whatever. But you can't tell that sitting on the roof at night, seeing all these flares all over the place and tracer bullets going up and artillery rounds popping in the distance. So
right. Okay, so the next morning you get on the helicopter and you're assigned to Advisory Team 70.
Mm-hmm.
And where did you go exactly?
Well, we flew out. It's about 40 miles north of Saigon in Binh Duong Province, near the capital city of Phu Cuong in Binh Duong Province, little village called Lam Son.
Mm-hmm.
Fifth Infantry Division, Vietnamese Fifth Infantry Division, which is Su Duan Nam Bo Binh,
mm-hmm.
and it's the division headquarters. Mm-hmm. And there's a little compound there. It was built by the French during when they were in Vietnam. It's called Ghazni Compound. It was named for a U.S. colonel that was shot down and killed in a helicopter attack about 3 years before that. There were about 70 guys there. And
70 Arvin or 70?
No, 70 Americans.
Okay.
And a few Koreans that we had there, too. But we, all of our guys were either Marines or Army.
Mm-hmm.
And our function was, quote, advisor, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
I never knew how I'm going to advise people who have been fighting a war for 10 years before I got there. But
that's a good point.
Yeah. Basically, we were just there to assist in any way possible, logistically,
mm-hmm.
militarily, and share information, whatnot. The division had three regiments.
Mm-hmm.
One was just down the road, and then one was further north in Binh Long Province,
mm-hmm.
and another was up further north in another province. This is three corps. The country was divided into four core regions. It was 1, 2, 3, 4 from north to south.
Right.
Three core. And so there were other Americans in our advisory team 70. Probably about half of us were at division headquarters, and the other half were assigned to three different regiments.
Okay.
Out in the field.
Okay. Tell me about what your living quarters were like and where you were housed and all of that.
Okay. It was kind of I'll send you some pictures if you want.
Sure.
But it was little concrete huts built by the French with no glass, but lots of screens all around, door mm-hmm. front and back, electricity sometimes, and each one housed about anywhere from 6 to 10 men, depending on who was there at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Concrete floors, no fans. We had to buy our own fans. All in all, it was rather comfortable. Reminded me of, like I think I said in my questionnaire, about my Boy Scout camp when I was younger. But overall, compared to living conditions, a lot of our men, especially the infantry, it was almost luxurious.
Mm-hmm.
At first, you said, my God, I got to spend a year here.
Mm-hmm.
But after a while, you know, it became home, and we had a little metal army cot. And that was it, a metal army cot. And anything else you wanted to get, if you wanted to have a footlocker or any kind of shelves or a chair or a table, you had to go scrounge around in the local towns and buy one from somebody or have somebody make you one.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the Vietnamese was a good carpenter that worked down at the interrogation center where I was, and he built me a chair and a table. I paid him for it, of course, and it wasn't too bad. We didn't spend a lot of time sleeping, but
mm-hmm.
it overall, it was okay.
Do you remember how much you paid for your chair and table?
I haven't got a clue.
Okay.
it wasn't money. It was cigarettes.
Okay. The Great American Barter.
Yeah, you did a lot of things there with cigarettes. You wanted something done, you give somebody a couple of cartons of Salem's or something, or Marlboro's, and
uh-huh.
they'll do about anything for it. I didn't smoke, but I bought a lot of cigarettes.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you had six guys in there?
It varied. We had anywhere from 4 to 8 or 9, depending. Some guys would come through there on temporary duty and stay a few days.
Mm-hmm.
We had about 5 or 6 guys that were there the whole time.
Were these other intelligence officers? Or
no, not officers. Just other grunts like me. Some of them work for, let's see, Rodney and Scott work for G2 with me, and a couple of the guys work for G3, transportation,
mm-hmm.
and a couple of guys were just assigned to our team as guards and clerks
mm-hmm.
at the base mm-hmm. command post.
How did you all get along?
Oh, just fine.
Yeah.
That's something. You know, we're all in the same boat there. At no time during my year there in this little compound did I recall any ill will, animosity, fights, nothing like that. Everybody, between the NCOs, the officers, the enlisted men, there was just a great sense of camaraderie and purpose. It was some of us didn't like some of the officers very well because they were basically incompetent jerks.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody else got along really well.
We
had a good esprit de corps, as French would say, I guess.
Mm-hmm. No racial incidents or anything?
Nothing of the sort. We had one of the guys in my building, in my hooch, as we call them, was a black guy from Washington, D.C., Richard T. Gilliam.
Mm-hmm.
We became good friends. We wrote for several years after we got back. There were several other black guys there, a couple of Hispanics. There were quite a few Koreans that came and went on the base from time to time. They were mainly officers. Everybody got along just fine.
Okay. So you said there was some tension between those who drafted or enlisted versus the
most
officer
corps? Most of the guys there were regular Army like me. In fact, we never really knew who was who.
And
we wouldn't have cared in any event because, like I said, we're all in the same boat.
Mm-hmm.
And got to make it work.
Okay. Any discussion of fragging, anything like that?
Nothing, never.
Okay.
That's something kind of overblown, too, but nothing like that.
Okay. Did you guys have enough supplies?
Oh, yeah.
That you needed?
We usually did. I worked with the G2 office, and we could have used a working typewriter from time to time. But in terms of just basic supplies, we didn't have any shortage of it. Sometimes we'd have to literally go out and steal stuff, but...
really?
Oh, yeah, we needed
from
a... Well, from other Army units, for example, we needed a... There came a time when we needed a three-quarter ton truck, and we didn't have a three-quarter ton truck to haul supplies and to haul prisoners around in. And we weren't authorized to have a three-quarter ton truck, so me and two other unnamed individuals, one of whom was a captain, just kind of got in the Jeep one day and drove over to Three Corps headquarters in Vienna, and there was this three-quarter ton truck sitting there, and and we stole it, and I drove it back, and we took it to the Vietnamese military paint shop and had it painted in Vietnamese Army colors and given in Vietnamese numbers on the bumpers and everything else, and that was that.
Did you find that the barter system, or either stealing, that the barter system was a good system?
That wasn't stealing. That was just creative requisition.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah, the barter system worked quite well. In fact, when I wanted to have some work done on this particular truck, I'd have to go down to the Vietnamese motor pool and pay off in cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
Since the truck, you know, didn't really show up anywhere with anybody's records, you know, we'd have to smooth over that hesitation with a couple of packs of Marlboros, and everything was just fine.
Okay. So tell me what your basic duties were.
Oh, geez.
Can you describe a typical day?
Yeah, I can try to be able to today. After a night of not much sleep, we had no particular working hours. You know, we didn't clock in or anything. I worked for the G2 section there, intelligence section at division level. We had a major who was a complete idiot, and two captains and lieutenant, both of whom weren't bad, and about seven enlisted men. And our job was to coordinate, quote-unquote, intelligence-gathering activities with the Vietnamese intelligence section, which is on the other side of the wall in our ramshackle, run-down building at headquarters. My job at first, since I was the only one there that spoke Vietnamese, was to translate a lot of the manuals that we had into Vietnamese. I never knew why. And also, we had four or five guys there that were intelligence analysts, and we divided up our division's territory into sectors, and each one of us would concentrate on a particular sector in terms of gathering information about enemy units and troops, VC and NVA, in that particular sector. And at the end of the week, we'd sit down and get the information we had and share it among ourselves and with the officers and see if we could spot any trends, decide what information was reliable, and then we would write a weekly intelligence report, an INT rep, and we would send that to the Vietnamese next door. They would send theirs to us, which I would then have to translate, and we would also ship ours up the chain of command to Three Corps, and we gather information from captured documents that the troops would bring in, interrogations that we would perform, captured weapons that we would analyze to see if we could tell who they belonged to, and okay, now what kind of weapon is this? And then we look at our order of battle, just like back at Fort Hollenberg. Okay, now what unit was supposed to have this weapon? You know, this kind of weapon. That what did this prisoner say? It was like a detective story, putting together a big puzzle, and we would keep a file on every unit, on every division, every brigade, regiment, squad that we would get information about, and gradually over time just kind of build up a picture of the names of the enemy soldiers in the unit, what kind of weapons they had. And every day was, there was no 2 days kind of the same. Some days I'd be on the base, some days I'd be in a helicopter out in the Iron Triangle or up at Loch Ninh or even perhaps in some neighboring country. I'd be at Bienwa sometimes, get picking up information about a unit that we would need. A lot of variation there. I'd interrogate prisoners sometimes, type reports, check over, go through weapons and look for markings. Sometimes the NVA would scratch their name on their weapon or scratch their unit on their weapon. They weren't supposed to, of course, but they could be stupid just like we were. And we'd have to check all that stuff out and get information from wherever we could. From national police, I would go to the national police sometimes with my Vietnamese counterparts and interrogate prisoners there. What have you heard about this? Discuss specific incidents that have been going on, because you never knew what was important and what was not. And then we have to make a prediction about what, okay, the North Vietnamese 271st Regiment, where do we think they are? What do we think their strength is? Where do we think they're going? This kind of thing. And, of course, since there were no front lines and enemy positions and headquarters shifted constantly, it was a constantly moving chessboard. But it was quite challenging. It had an intellectual aspect to it that I liked. Either when I was back at the base or out in the field or whatever, I spent a lot of my time then at the Vietnamese Division Interrogation Center, which was kind of half interrogation rooms and half barracks and half jail. I guess that's three halves. So no 2 days were alike. I had no real hours. I got up and went to work as soon as I could, and I stayed as late as I needed to, and had guard duty every other night for 6 hours a night, and, you know, unpredictable, a phone call might come in. Marshal, they need you over at First Air Cab. They got a prisoner. Get over there. You know, this kind of stuff. So the unpredictable nature of it was kind of nice. It kept it from being monotonous. You knew that, you know, it wasn't the same thing day in, day out.
Right.
But, you know, there was no hours. We work on Saturday and Sunday. Sometimes we didn't even know what day it is or what month it was. That was kind of a funny thing. You know, anyone know what day this is? Thursday, isn't it? No, it's Sunday. Are you kidding me? You know? So it made the time go faster.
Right.
The lack of monotony in that regard and the tremendous variation in daily routine. So I enjoyed that.
Okay. Let's go through some of these activities. And can you describe them for me just briefly what you did, and or not briefly, basically. Just tell me what your impressions were. Let's talk about, you said that, well, first you said you type up these manuals, which you thought was pointless.
Yeah, well, I only spent a few days on that because I could just tell Major Anderson that I'm finished, and he couldn't tell the difference one way or the other because he didn't speak the language. But there were just a few manuals that he thought it might be helpful to have translated into English, translated from English into Vietnamese. He's probably just checking me out. Can he do this? And of course he couldn't tell anyway, but he could take him over to the Vietnamese next door and say that I did it.
Right.
Did he do it right? So that was just a very minor thing. That was just the first thing I remember that I did.
Right. My question was leading to, were there a lot of tasks that you felt like were not very useful for you to be spending your time on, or did you feel like you were assigned to doing things that was very time worthy?
No. Yeah. I thought I was kind of left to my own devices. There was supposed to be an officer in charge of me specifically, but there wasn't until just maybe a month or so in my tour. So it was me, and I was only a Spec 4 at the time, E4, and two Vietnamese sergeants, Sergeant Mike Cao Vo and Sergeant Tran Van Nguyen. And basically, I was just kind of left up to my own devices. As long as I checked in every day and to see if there was anything that the officers, that Captain Pochard or Captain Lieutenant Small or Major Anderson wanted me to do specifically, then I was kind of on my own to pick and choose what should I do today. Should I go down to the National Police and see if they have any prisoners that we need to talk to. Should I go down to IPW Center and check to see if they picked up anybody last night?
Mm-hmm.
The division had a reconnaissance platoon called the Recondos, and they were led by a special forces lieutenant. And they would didn't see them too much because they were always out in the boonies.
Mm-hmm.
But every once in a while, they'd bring in a captured prisoner. They'd bring in some documents to be translated. So there was always something to do. So I was kind of on my own in terms of prioritizing what I needed to do any particular day.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, that helped break up the monotony quite a bit.
Tell me about the prisoners and your interaction with them, their interrogations and things like that. How would you go about it?
Okay. If I knew there were prisoners there, sometimes the Vietnamese would bring people in and ship them out again without us knowing about it, although they were usually pretty cooperative. We picked up we would get prisoners in a variety of ways. Some would just walk in and say, "I surrender," or "Chiu Hoi."
Right.
We dropped zillions of leaflets out in the jungle, in the woods, and
mm-hmm.
Cambodia and Laos. In fact, I still have a couple in the basement here, safe conduct packs.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that would be very effective. They would just show up at a police station or an army post or someplace. Any prisoners up through... See, we were division level, so we could basically handle any prisoner from any level unit. But our section, our G2 section, was mainly interested in prisoners from company level on down, or small unit stuff. Anybody from higher level units, we would ship off to 3 Court, BNOI, for interrogation.
Okay.
But we would get prisoners, returnees or Chiu Hoi, the various Vietnamese units, the 3 regiments of the 5th Division would capture prisoners frequently,
mm-hmm.
North Vietnamese and Viet Cong. Sometimes National Police would capture prisoners that they thought were significant. They weren't just some low-level guide or something. This is somebody that we might want to talk to, and they would ship them over to us. We had in this building, the whole Vietnamese base was built by the Japanese in World War II as a prison camp, and it was a pretty grim place because the buildings were kind of ramshackle, tile roofs, brick walls, and barbed wire ceilings.
Wow.
The ceilings were barbed wire, and they had gun slits, firing slits in all the walls, and the slits flared inward, not outward.
Huh.
So it was a very grim place, and we had kind of I guess 4 or 5 really cramped, dim cells there at the IPW, Interrogation and Prisoner of War Center,
okay.
Which was on the corner, far corner of the base, about half a mile walk from our little compound.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent more time there than anything else. And I didn't do any interrogations on my own at first. I hadn't had any specific training except some general training at Fort Holabird.
Mm-hmm.
But I was allowed to sit in on them, and I understood enough Vietnamese to make it on my own. If I had a question, I just asked one of my 2 Vietnamese counterparts, Sergeant Nguyen. And I was surprised at how civil these things went.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of apprehensive that there would be torture and beatings and things like this. Some
mm-hmm.
of these Vietnamese guys were pretty angry at what the communists had done to their country. But
were you prepared for such things? Did they know how to react to that?
I was prepared for that. I also was prepared that I knew I couldn't interfere, which would bother me. I didn't approve of that. But it rarely happened. A couple of times there were a few slaps and punch in the face on one occasion that I recall.
Mm-hmm.
But more often, the prisoners that came in that were picked up, these guys, they didn't want to be there anymore
mm-hmm.
than a lot of our guys did. And most of them would just tell you anything you want to know. We'd have to see if they were lying, because all the communist units, even down to the very smallest squad, they have a political officer
mm-hmm.
who is there to watch his own men, you know, it's groupthink with these guys. But they were very forthcoming. If nobody would talk, if the guy would just sit there and say he wouldn't talk, then fine. We'd put him on a truck or a jeep the next day and send him over to BNY. to be interrogated over there at Three Corps headquarters. Mm-hmm. But most of the people I talked with, they were amazed, especially the North Vietnamese, amazed to see an American sitting there.
Really?
With Vietnamese. And
why was that?
They had been, you know, the communist propaganda machine is quite intense. You know, the Americans are here to kill and rape and murder and take over Vietnam and there, you know, et cetera. But when they saw me sitting there with Vietnamese guys who were obviously my friends, it was kind of unnerving for them. And I'm sure in many cases they thought, you know, maybe somebody's lied to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I always put them off guard because we get these guys and we had to fly up to, I remember taking prisoners out of the Iron Triangle on several occasions. It'd be a big operation or a battle going in there.
Mm-hmm.
And we get on a helicopter and go up there and pick up the prisoners from an American or Vietnamese unit, depending, and bring them back to where we were. And quite often we had a couple of little boxes there in the room and full of Reese's peanut butter cups and
mm-hmm.
toothpaste and soap and things like that. And we'd get these things out, and these guys were filthy, and they smelled bad, and they had a horrible experience on their own. They'd just been bombed and shot and blown up, and we'd bring them back, and they were just scared to death. And, you know, so what did we do? Want a peanut butter cup, which in many cases they'd never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
Bar of soap, toothpaste, washcloth, you know, you go clean yourself up. And sometimes that was all it took. And when they became aware that we weren't going to hurt them, weren't going to torture them, weren't going to toss them out of a helicopter, although I don't deny that some of those things I'm sure happened other places.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our interrogations became basically just conversations, and when we thought we had enough information, and we ship them on off to Three Corps headquarters. And it was quite interesting to see most of the Americans over there, they never got to sit right down with an enemy soldier.
Right.
You know, they could shoot them and come in over the wire or blow them up or gas them out of a foxhole or whatever or a
mm-hmm.
tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of just talking to them one-on-one, man-to-man, that was a unique experience,
mm-hmm.
For me at least, because we had lots of it. Every unit, of course, would have its interrogators over there. But I had a great sense of pride in that. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm here's the enemy. I'm sitting here, and he's sitting over there. And he might hate my guts, but he's on my turf now.
Did you get a sense that they hated your guts?
Not really. Some of them did. Especially the NVA officers,
mm-hmm.
who are really heavily, of course, indoctrinated and hardcore communists. They wouldn't say a word. They wouldn't even give their name, rank, and serial number, and we could tell right off the bat who was going to be cooperative and who wasn't. And if somebody wasn't, there wasn't much point in keeping them around there. And we had a Vietnamese truck driver and soldiers that ran basically a shuttle between our place and Bien Hoa headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes they would get sent to a higher level Vietnamese unit. Most of them just went to Bien Hoa, the Third
mm-hmm.
Corps headquarters, where
mm-hmm.
they could be interrogated there, or just in prison. You know, you're not going to talk. War's over for you. You get a cot and 3 square meals a day. Good luck.
Right.
But I don't know how many interrogations I did. I had to type all this stuff up, though, and submit it up the chain of command. Dozens and dozens over the course of a year, everybody from just VC to North Vietnamese colonel at one point, who just walked in one day to a national police station and said, I surrender. That was the highest one I remember. But it was quite an experience. It's something that very few soldiers ever get a chance to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried to do it in a kind way. You know, my philosophy was, I'm going to catch more flies with honey.
Mm-hmm.
And
was that your call, or was that your Vietnamese counterpart's call?
Both of ours together.
Okay.
They were nice guys too. We sometimes play good cop bad cop,
mm-hmm.
on occasion, and sometimes that would work. But our basic goal, you know, it was our standing orders were, what unit are these guys in,
mm-hmm.
and where are they?
Right.
As best you can find out, what is their just basic questions? What is their strength? What is their mission? Where have they been? You know, does this guy remember any places that he can identify from signs or hamlet or village names or anything
mm-hmm.
else? And usually they didn't know. Often they didn't know, but whatever they did know,
mm-hmm.
the names of guys in your unit, what kind of weapons do you have, how many rounds of ammunition, how's morale, how's your food, You know, and if they came down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, as they often did, we could trace them down the trail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we get some young kid in there, 16, 17 years old. What'd you do? I carried a 122-millimeter rocket warhead or rocket shell down the Ho Chi Minh Trail in a pack on my back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what were you supposed to do when you got here? Go back and get another one. You know, and I didn't want to.
Right.
So he would turn himself in and things like that. Some of these guys, they were just kids. I mean, they were just teenagers. They were younger than our soldiers. They were illiterate. They were just commandeered and shanghaied into the army. Like I said, in North Vietnam, I mean, they want you. You go. You don't go to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Don't go to China.
Mm-hmm.
So it's we often felt a lot of sympathy for some of these guys. They were just kids that just basically were slaves. You will take this weapons to South Vietnam, and you will get killed, maybe, and when you're done, you will come back up here and get some more. Some of them rode bikes, some walked, some came down in trucks. And it was quite an education to me to see how these people fought and how they lived and everything else. And again, a lot of them were just astonished that I, as an American, was just a normal guy.
Mm-hmm.
That I didn't have any enmity toward them. I didn't hate their people, hate their country.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't care much for their government and their military commanders, but they had nothing to fear from me personally.
Right.
And that was good. Sometimes we get a lot of prisoners in at one time in an operation, and we'd have to call in support from other advisory teams or from three corps. Sometimes they'd send other interrogators over there, both American and Vietnamese, and we just kind of have a mass interrogation, and we kind of sit down and try to figure out what it all meant. We did have some successes, though, that we're kind of proud of. During the Tet Offensive, we had a prisoner that was picked up by the Vietnamese, and we brought him in. And it was a lot of fun because we couldn't turn any lights on at that time. We were doing everything by flashlight.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out this guy was from our old nemesis, the North Vietnamese 9th Division, 273rd Regiment. And we eventually got him to tell us, where is your regiment? And he just pointed.
Really?
He just pointed. He said, we're about 500 meters over there in those woods.
Really?
Yeah.
Out the window or out a map?
Basically across the wall and across the end of our landing strip and across a little field there with some woods.
Wow.
And he said, we're right over there, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of scary because, again, the main North Vietnamese unit in our area operating at that time was North Vietnamese 9th Division, which
mm-hmm.
had three regiments, the 271st, 272nd, the 273rd. And they were the ones we really tried to keep tabs on.
Mm-hmm.
And they were right there, at least his regiment was. So,
What would you do with that information?
Well, we took the information, and I gave it to my Lieutenant Petrero, a Notre Dame graduate, among his other faults. And he took it back to Captain Pochert, and Captain Pochert took it back to whoever our commander was at the time, and he got on the phone to Third Corps, and in a few hours, there were F-105s coming in there just bombing the heck out of that place.
Mm-hmm.
And some of our soldiers went in the next morning, and sure enough, there were a lot of dead North Vietnamese in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had another prisoner during the Tet Offensive that Sergeant Vo and I were called over to the 1st Air Cav, which had a base about 2 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a prisoner, and they didn't have anybody that could talk to him. Because during the Tet Offensive, their Vietnamese interpreters and translators, they went home on leave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so they called me and Sergeant Vo over there. And we talked to this guy for a while, and we found out what unit he was from, which, and I have I can't remember what he was from, but their unit, which was a new unit that I'd never heard of,
mm-hmm.
Their mission was to attack the Marine base, the Vietnamese Marine base at Hon Quan near Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got that information to them to be on the lookout for that. And this unit ended up being intercepted between where we were and Saigon, so that attack was prevented. So
mm-hmm.
we did have some success from time to time. You know, sometime we were just kind of spitting into the wind, but then the information ultimately was probably no tactical use to anybody, at least at the time. But on those two occasions, we did all right.
Mm-hmm.
Figured we saved some lives and maybe even our own.
Mm-hmm.
So,
how would you verify your information?
Well, from the prisoners, we would cross-check it with other information because,
okay.
like I said, we kept a file on every unit, local VC units, and especially the North Vietnamese 9th Division and all of its units. We had it broken down pretty good. And we would cross-check it with previous information and documents that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And if we found some inconsistencies, now, you say that your unit was over here by the Dong Nai River, you know, but we got another guy from your unit 2 weeks ago, and he said that you were up by Loch Ninh, so, you know. And sometimes I'd admit, yeah, okay, you're right, we're wrong, I lied. But often checking information was not our responsibility. We would, that was Three Corps' responsibility or division responsibility. We would just, here's the unit, you know, here's the information, we think it's reliable, you double check it, and if you want to make sense out of it, fine.
Right.
But usually the guys were telling the truth. They didn't have no reason to lie. They were, the war was over for them. And a lot of them, especially just the North Vietnamese foot soldiers, they didn't want to be there anyway.
Right.
You know, the officers, they were, they rarely talked, except on a, some occasions where they just surrendered. If they were captured, they would rarely say anything. We had, Sergeant Vo and I had to fly up to Loch Ninh, which is right on the Cambodian border, and pick up a Vietnamese lieutenant, a Viet Cong lieutenant, and who had surrendered. And he had, you know, officers were wonderful because they could give us a lot of information that the ordinary enlisted man, he would not know. The enlisted men, they wouldn't know tactics and strategy and missions and things like that. They wouldn't even know what they, where they were going, what they were going to do when they got there until somebody said, open fire.
Right.
But the officers, they had a lot higher level of intelligence. And we had to fly up there and get this guy. And we had to, when we got up there, our helicopter had a malfunction and couldn't take off. So we had this Canadian Air Force Caribou, horrible plane, terrible thing, sitting there. And he was going to Vung Tau. And we go, okay, we'll fly with you to Vung Tau on the coast, and then we'll try to get a helicopter back to Tan Son Nhut, then get another helicopter back to Nam Son. Helicopters like bus systems back there.
This is with your prisoner.
It's kind of neat. So we get this he's a Viet Cong lieutenant in uniform. He has little epaulets on his shoulders and everything, little, and a pith helmet and a whole bit, and little brass star in the middle, a North Vietnamese star. But he was VC. And we got on the helicopter in the Caribou and took off, flew to Vung Tau, and got a helicopter back to Tan Son Nhut. And we got back there, and the last helicopter going our way, going back up to Lam Son, had already gone. So we had to spend the night there, sitting in this little shed, little like a big fancy bus stop with wooden benches in it. And here we are sitting in all night with this VC lieutenant, who's obviously a VC, a communist officer. We got a lot of crazy looks from other people, especially other Army officers, you know, who are you and who is this guy? And we had the ID and we had our orders and everything. And it was just kind of, this guy was just amazed. He was, he just stood there in front of the hut the whole time and watched all this incredible variety of airplanes coming and going and helicopters coming and going. And he was very cooperative. We got him back the next morning, and he gave quite a bit of helpful information about Viet Cong operations in the northern part of Three Corps. And we just added that to our files and our dossier. But there, we did have a few fun times.
Was that, that was one of them?
That was one of them.
Okay, okay. Well, tell me the basic differences that you noticed between the Viet Cong that you interrogated, that you talked with, and then the NVA.
Yeah, the Viet Cong, at least the ones I talked with, and again, I can only speak from my personal experience,
of course.
I'm sure what I have to say about these guys could easily be contradicted by other people in other places. But the VC that we talked to seemed to have an inferiority complex. The North Vietnamese kind of treated them like dirt. I think I made the comment somewhere in my questionnaire that their fighting skill was somewhat overrated. The VC in our area mainly acted as guides for the North Vietnamese Army. Of course, the VC are local people. And they bury their weapons and, you know, plow their fields during the day and throw grenades at night. But for the most part, I found the VC pretty cooperative, rather forthcoming. Since they were in South Vietnam, they could see that the Americans were literally there to help the South Vietnamese. That for the most part, they had nothing to fear from them on a personal level. Militarily, yeah, you know, kill them if we could. But when they surrendered, they were usually very forthcoming and very cooperative because they felt a high level of camaraderie and kinship with the South Vietnamese because they were South Vietnamese. And sometimes that would override any political considerations. North Vietnamese, the enlisted guys, as I recall, usually were pretty cooperative, pretty forthcoming. Some of the NCOs and the officers, they wouldn't say a word. You know, we'd couldn't get a word out of them. We'd have some, sometimes they'd have papers on them. We'd at least know their name and unit and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, they were far more resilient to questioning than the VC were.
Okay.
Plus, they had a better lifestyle for the most part. The VC, they live like pigs a lot of the time. They're the ones that lived in tunnels. They had a kind of a loose command structure for the most part, although the VC did have some large military-type units.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the ones in our area, at least, our little part of the world, were just mainly guides and get supplies and third-rate kidnappers and terrorists and this kind of thing, mm-hmm. instead of being a main force fighting unit.
Could you tell a physical difference between the two?
Not really. The VC often did wear their proverbial black pajamas.
Mm-hmm.
As did many of the NVA, but the NVA also had a variety of kind of light green and khaki uniforms. And they were part of a much more rigid, structured command structure than the VC were.
Mm-hmm.
It were just, you know, just local people were operating often in just small cells, almost to the point of being a paramilitary unit.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that was just in our area. Other parts of the country, the VC did have pretty sophisticated fighting units and did a pretty good job.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they were good at infiltrating. They were the sappers and the saboteurs and whatnot. And
right.
They were a lot of the ones that were caused so much damage in Saigon during the Tet Offensive because the NVA, they didn't know the area. They relied on the VC to tell them where to go and where to be and where to hide and whatnot, and where to steal food and what village you could kidnap people to carry your equipment for you and everything else. So they worked together. And then further north, up in I Corps, the NVA operated more or less on their own. They didn't need the VC because they were very close to North Vietnam as it was.
Mm-hmm. What kind of weapons would you find on them, or would they bring in with them?
Okay. The standard arm back then was the AK-47.
Right.
We would not usually capture prisoners with weapons. On a few occasions, they were brought in with their weapons, and that was almost always the ubiquitous AK-47. Occasionally, there'd be a few grenades. Of course, these are almost all Chinese, Russian, Czechoslovakian. They made very little of their own armaments.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't get many prisoners with weapons. We did get thousands of weapons, though, after an operation, after a battle. Sometimes we'd have to go out and collect these ourselves, sometimes prying them from somebody's cold, dead fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes one of our units or a Vietnamese unit would find an arms cache because they would often just bury their weapons in advance and in a certain spot. But often we get them after big operations or after specific battles. And that was another aspect of our job because anything captured by the 5th Division ended up in our little building, and we had to check them over. To see, you know, we'd like to know, what has the enemy got?
Right.
Anything new or just the same old stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And every once in a while, the new type of anti-personnel mine would show up, or there was a certain point when they started getting these 122-millimeter rocket launchers. They started showing up at a certain point when I was there, at least showing up in our area. That was something new to us, and those things were fun.
Mm-hmm.
But that's part of what I keep calling the order of battle. What
right.
kind of weapons these people have? Because sometimes you can tell what their tactics are, or what their weapons are. This unit, for example, may have a lot of Bangalore torpedoes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. They're a sabotage unit. They're in there to blow something up. You know what? And other units might just have machine guns and AK-47s. They're more of just an attack unit.
Mm-hmm.
And so some units have a lot of mortars. They had 82-millimeter mortars, which could use our shells because we had 81-millimeter mortars. So they could capture our shells and drop them down their mortar tubes. And so that was fun for them.
Mm-hmm.
So weapons analysis was a lot of fun, too. And we had Russian gunners' quadrants and flamethrowers and a variety of rifles and machine guns and 50-caliber machine guns and just all kind of stuff. And, again, if some units would have certain markings, and sometimes in code, what unit it was, and we'd have to try to break the code. Okay, where did this guy say he was from? And he was this was his commanding officer, and he was from what unit? And this is the code. And again, it's more the detective story aspect of it. But all the weapons, the Vietnamese would like to sometimes, if we get a lot of the weapons, a lot of weapons from a particular unit, particular North Vietnamese unit, they put them on trucks and drive them. We put banners on them showing that, you see, we're fighting for you. We're trying to do a good job. We're going to defeat the North Vietnamese, and all kind of patriotic slogans on these trucks, and drive them through local towns and villages showing off what they captured.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever come across any Chinese troops?
No.
None?
Didn't have any indication there were any Chinese in Vietnam. The North Vietnamese and the Chinese don't get along very well.
Mm-hmm.
Never did.
Right.
And never had any indication there were any Chinese or Russians or Cubans or North Koreans or Klingons or anybody else down there besides the North Vietnamese. There may have been. I don't know.
How about any Pathet Lao or Khmer?
No, never had any contact with them. Never got to Laos. I won't mention Cambodia, but never got to Laos. Never had any contact with them at all.
So you never went into Laos?
No.
Okay, but you did go into Cambodia?
No comment.
Okay. Okay.
I might have been.
Okay.
The border was kind of fluid.
Were you instructed to basically not answer questions like that as long as you were out of the service?
No. No. It's just I don't know if I was in Cambodia or not, to be honest about it.
Really?
I really don't.
Okay. You would just go out and do your operation. You might or might not have been there.
We were told, go here, land at these coordinates, pick up this stuff, pick
right.
up this person. Sergeant Vole on a couple of occasions said, Marshal, I think we were in Cambodia. But I don't know.
Uh-huh. Okay. What would you say were the strengths of the NVA and VC?
Well, their tenacity was always impressive. They were indoctrinated and conditioned for one simple thing, that they were going to win the war. It didn't matter how many men we had.
Right.
Didn't matter how many B-52s or battleships or whatever, that ultimately they would win simply because they would persevere and we would eventually quit. And
mm-hmm.
that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
They were incredibly tenacious, at least on the officer level and on the soldier level too. A lot of their guys, they were just as sincere about their cause as we were about ours.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always impressed with their ability to die for their country.
Right.
And we'd find these tunnel complexes and everything, and we'd talk to these prisoners who just had an absolutely hellish time, and their whole unit had,
Mm-hmm.
They'd be blasted by B-52s, which do funny things to the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd come out of their holes and fight. They'd walk hundreds of miles. They'd carry all this garbage on their back. They'd live like pigs. They'd have just a very eclectic diet.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd still fight. And I was always very impressed. I was always very impressed by their resilience and their tenacity.
Okay.
At least the ones I talked to.
Right. Well, you had a lot of face-to-face contact with them.
Yeah.
What would you say were their weaknesses?
Well, they were treated like dogs and by their own officers. Each unit had a political officer, if anybody says or thinks anything out of the ordinary. So even within their own units, they didn't seem to be highly valued, which is why a lot of them just surrendered. And probably we had as many people just surrender as that we quit as get captured.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of weaknesses, again, they had good leadership. They had good weapons. They had good training. Their weaknesses might be a tendency to be sometimes overconfident, to make an attack or make a movement that they thought they could get away with.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhat, like in the Civil War, the Southern troops would often just charge the Union lines no matter if the Union was dug in or not, in
mm-hmm.
kind of an arrogant way.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they get the impression that they would do that too, that, since we're going to win, then we can't lose. So we'll just go out here and show ourselves and make this attack in the daylight or whatnot, or we won't bother to cover our fires or something like that. And,
mm-hmm.
and I think they made some bad moves like that from time to time, underestimating us.
Right.
That may have been one of their biggest weaknesses, is underestimating the abilities and resolve and power of the American military.
Mm-hmm.
We're just the imperialist running dogs their master said we were.
Right.
And, we're soft. We're a bunch of drug-abusing alcoholics, and I kind of got the impression from interrogations and from reading captured documents and things that there was a tendency to underestimate us as often as we underestimated them.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of a learning process for both sides, I guess.
Were their documents real propagandistic?
Oh, geez.
In nature?
I got a bunch of them in the basement. In fact, I'm going to be coming through Lubbock next summer. I might just drop all this stuff off and give it to you people.
You should do that. We can definitely preserve it for you here.
I don't need it. But a lot of their we would have leaflets, safe conduct passes that we drop in their territory,
mm-hmm.
and around Christmas time and Easter time especially, these documents, these little slips from their side would magically turn up in our areas. And I got one that from Christmas that it was written in terrible English, but it basically says, "Why do you Americans persist in fighting a war you cannot win? Don't let Johnson and McNamara kill you. Your family is home now under a verdant blooming pine tree." Yeah, Christmas tree, I guess. You don't let them see you in a coffin or a pine box or whatever. You know, mm-hmm. surrender now to the victorious People's Army, and we'll treat you well. So, mm-hmm. have a lot of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I got some North Vietnamese and Viet Cong award certificates, and they're all, if you translate them, they're kind of hilarious too. This stilted Stalinist type propaganda stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, congratulations to, you know, fill in name here, for resolutely smiting them peerless running dogs and stuff like that, you know.
Right.
But that's their style.
Right.
Know.
Did you think that these guys actually bought that? Did you feel like they were hardcore communists?
Well, the officers were,
okay.
for the most part, except for one North Vietnamese colonel we had. I got the impression, for the most part, they bought into this.
They were true believers.
This was their culture. Yeah, the true believers is a good term. This was their mission in life, is to unite the world under the socialist banner, you know. So,
mm-hmm. How about the Viet Cong?
I think the Viet Cong were just kind of waiting for a payday, you know.
Okay.
We've been sitting down here since 1954 after Dien Bien Phu and after the truce, and we buried our weapons, and we've been good little communists, and we've done what you told us, you know. When do we get paid?
Mm-hmm.
This kind of stuff, at least the ones in our area.
Right.
You know, there are many good books written about the VC, Douglas Pike's book, Viet Cong, and a lot of others.
Right.
But again, from the VC in our little area, we're just mainly a guide.
You mentioned Douglas Pike. He was here for quite a few years,
yeah.
before he passed last
yeah.
year. Did you read his stuff on?
I've read some of his material. I read part of his book years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a guy.
What do you think of the writing, if you can remember it?
Very accurate, very realistic, I thought. I thought he did a good job of research.
Okay. Okay. Did your opinion of the American effort in the war change at all over this year that you had so much contact with the enemy?
Well, my opinion changed in terms of when are we going to win this thing? You know, here we are piddling around with a third-rate country, and they got a big army, but so what? We have tremendous power, and we never used it. We kind of got involved in this philosophy of incrementalism. You know, we'd send a few more troops over, and they'd match us, and we'd send a few more troops over, and they'd match us. You know, and I felt from the beginning, if you're going to fight a war, win it. Go all out.
Mm-hmm.
The sooner you win it, the fewer people get killed, the less damage is done.
Mm-hmm.
But I was disillusioned by our philosophy or tactics of incrementalism. And once we got to the point where we, like I think I said several times in my questionnaire, that it was obvious that we weren't going to try to win it. We were just going to try to have a truce,
mm-hmm.
like in Korea. That's worked really well.
Mm-hmm.
So I get disillusioned in terms of our tactics, not in terms of what President Reagan said was the nobility of our aims.
Right.
But the way we went about it, a lot of us were thinking, when are we going to stop screwing around and win the war? You know, it's been going for 10 years now,
mm-hmm.
and we just keep piddling around. We don't seem to learn from our mistakes.
Why was that going on, do you think?
Huh?
Why do you think that was happening?
I don't know. This is the first political war that I recall in U.S. history, although politics enter into all wars. But we just never seemed to be able to articulate a strategy, to have consistent political leadership. The North Vietnamese seemed to be quite successful at fomenting dissent within our own country, as all of our college students here were demonstrating for years with no knowledge of what was going on at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still puzzling to me, even after all these years, as I'm sure it is to many people,
mm-hmm.
why we couldn't win the war. Of course, it was a different kind of war, and how you define victory is, of course, sometimes an exercise in semantics.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel we could have done a heck of a lot more damage to North Vietnam than we did. We didn't have to defend ourselves about going into Cambodia and Laos. I mean, the propaganda comes out, all the newspapers say, we're invading Cambodia and Laos. No, we're not. We're attacking North Vietnamese troops in Cambodia and Laos. What do you what's the problem with that? Mm-hmm. We never seem to be able to, at least only on the government level, to articulate our aims, to answer questions about tactics and strategy and things like invading Cambodia, this kind of stuff. And I never could understand, why is it so hard to say what we're doing and why and what's going on? Why do all of our mistakes and screw-ups get publicized, but the incredible brutality and viciousness of the enemy sometimes never even makes it into the paper? You know, the Tet Offensive, hailed as a huge communist victory. They got slaughtered everywhere in the country. But that got turned into a big victory by the media and nothing else. And the butchery of the North Vietnamese in Hue, going into the city with lists of people, taking them out and executing them with a bullet in the head by the thousands, burying them in mass graves. I didn't see any protest and demonstrations over that. There was a town, I mean, My Lai got a lot of attention, and rightfully so. That was an aberration. And the people involved with that, they should have paid the price. They didn't. But there was a little village up in Northern Three Corps up in Binh Long Province while I was there called Shang Bay. And the people in Shang Bay had recently incurred the displeasure of the North Vietnamese by picking up their village en masse and moving to a safer location near a South Vietnamese outpost. And the North Vietnamese didn't like that. So they went in there one night and threw grenades into every hut and shot and killed everybody they could. Meanwhile, on a mountain base, a mountain position a couple miles away, there was a South Vietnamese ranger unit that saw what was going on but could not get there to do anything about it. And they, the North Vietnamese slaughtered hundreds of people in this one village. And this got three lines of print in Time magazine in an issue the following week. You know, now if it had been Americans had done that, it would have been full-scale in congressional investigation and demonstrations and whatnot. But the communists did things like this as a matter of policy all the time. Horrible brutality, kidnapping whole villages, shelling refugees, you know, the whole bit. And somehow were never brought to task for it. They were seen to be given a pass because their ultimate aims are noble for some reason. So I found that quite aggravating, still do, quite honestly, after all these years, that our screw-ups, and rightfully so, were highlighted and publicized and questioned. But those of the enemy, which were consistent, and far worse, on a consistent daily basis, all of our little college protesters back here, when they're chanting, Ho, Ho, Ho Chi Minh, do you know what the guy's doing to people? Do you know what they've done since the fall of Vietnam in 75? Nobody seems to care.
Right. Well, one of my questions was, what did you think of the media coverage on the war?
Pathetic.
You've talked about that a bit here.
Pathetic. Even while we were there, pathetic. I still remember Mike Wallace and Peter Jennings having a conversation on TV some years ago. And they were both Vietnam correspondents. And Peter Jennings asked Mike Wallace, now, if you were on patrol with one of our teams and you saw that there was an ambush, you saw the enemy up ahead, would you warn our men? And Mike Wallace said, no, I wouldn't. That's not my job as a reporter. You know, I said, this guy is morally bankrupt. To equate our men with these other guys is just inexcusable to me. But I don't know. The press coverage over there, it was managed, I guess, by the government as well as possible. It was just, this is the first war in living color on your TV screen at 6 o'clock every night. You know, it was the first war that Americans had ever seen like that. They'd never seen wounded and dying soldiers. They'd never seen somebody's guts hanging out, you know, and these horrible wounds and men crying in pain. And that's war. It's terrible. It's horrible. But that's what war is, unfortunately. And I saw a lot of horrible things do. I saw dead bodies and heads blown off and arms laying on the ground and feet and you name it. Eyeballs. But
how did you deal with all that, personally?
I just kind of put it out of my mind. You know, obviously, this is bad. That could have been me. That could have been Sergeant Vo. Thank God it wasn't. It was extremely unsettling at first, but I managed to just kind of put it out of my mind and not let it bother me. I said, if it starts to bother me, it's going to really interfere with my ability to do my job and my ability to stay alive. So I just kind of put it out of my mind. But the media coverage of the war and people like Jane Fonda and all that still still rankles me to this day, as well as the treatment of Vietnam veterans as a whole and the whole media portrayal of Vietnam veterans in general, even to this day, it's still unsettling to me.
Well, you've talked a little bit about the political leadership, the lack thereof. What about the military leadership in Washington and then back in country in Vietnam?
Well, of course, a lot of that stuff I don't know any more than what read in Time and Newsweek and Life and saw in the evening news.
That's okay.
But we didn't. Again, General Westmoreland, he seemed to be a very capable man, very capable, realistic leader.
Mm-hmm.
General Abrams, I think he followed more in the same vein. I think a lot of lower echelon commanders, though, division commanders, company commanders, commanders in three corps, brigade level, regiment, whatever, some of those guys, including some I knew quite personally, basically were just out to build their resumes in some cases,
right.
You know, just get a body count, whatnot, lie about it. There have been many movies made about this, most of which don't reflect any of my experiences, but I think a lot of our lower-level leadership in many cases wasn't too good. But, of course, on the other hand, a lot of our officers and men, they're the best soldiers we ever had, as far as I'm concerned. They're the best we ever produced to go through what they went through over there and come through unscathed with their integrity intact. I have nothing but pride in those guys.
Mm-hmm.
But our military, because of political considerations, as far as I'm concerned, was never able to prosecute the war from simply a military point of view. There's always political considerations. If we do this, what is France going to think? Who cares?
Mm-hmm.
If we do this, what are the Chinese going to do? Who cares? But we did not give military considerations and tactical considerations, I don't think, the priority and impact we should have without second-guessing everybody. And I'm sure there were a lot of commanders in the field that were hesitant to act on their own initiative. You know, if I do this, am I going to get in front of a congressional committee? Is there going to be some reporter with a microphone in my face second-guessing my every move, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure there was a lot of reluctance and hesitancy in many situations where people didn't do the right thing or the appropriate thing because of the media, because of political considerations, whatever. So it was just a screwed-up effort from the beginning.
What would you have advocated that the United States could have done differently?
Well, I would have put a lot more men in a lot sooner. I would have done a lot more to somehow get the South Vietnamese government to act a little more democratic toward its own people.
Mm-hmm.
I would have done a heck of a lot more damage to North Vietnam. I would have carried the war into Cambodia and Laos because that was the main supply line.
Mm-hmm.
We let these trucks and jeeps and tanks and artillery pieces come down this very well-maintained network of roads almost unimpeded for the most part. Again, we just, I think overall we applied our power foolishly.
Okay.
In an extended incremental fashion, instead of if we thought right was on our side, if we thought this war was worth fighting, then get in and fight the war. Stop screwing around and stringing things out year after year and changing your rationale and changing your point of view. And of course, this great hindsight on my part, being a little Spec 5 in South Viet, somewhere north of Saigon. But you know, I know a lot of guys have felt that way, and a lot still do.
Right. Well, we can talk about that a little later as far as overall U.S. policy and lessons learned and things like that. Let's get back to what you were doing there in country. Tell me, what weapons did you carry?
I had an M16,
mm-hmm.
which was a piece of junk as far as I was concerned. Hey, we had to keep it clean constantly. It wouldn't fire.
Did you have the Model A?
I don't
know.
I think so.
Was
I think it was. We got some training when we got there.
Uh-huh.
I had a 30 caliber World War II carbine, an M1.
Okay.
Automatic. I had a grenade launcher, an M69 grenade launcher, and a Browning automatic rifle from World War I.
Wow.
So that's just what I had stacked up in my hooch, and it I rarely use any of them. The 30 caliber carbine was probably the best that you could drop it in the mud and it still work. And the Browning was really heavy, and I only shot that a few times.
I was going to ask you, when did you ever have to fire weapons?
Only a couple times, and I'm not even sure I hit anything. We had a couple of incidents that we thought our little warning siren went off a couple times, quite a few times at night. And there were a couple times that we thought we saw some people out in our kill zone in front of our berm, mm-hmm. our defensive perimeter that shouldn't be there. And, you know, we'd open up on them, but we'd never find anything. We'd go out and send somebody out in the morning, and we never really found anything. I only did that maybe, I don't know, two or three times the whole year. And just because, all right, shoot over there and see if anything happens, you know, this kind of thing. No particular threat. Nobody specifically standing up and shooting at us, although that did happen sometimes. But
was this during your guard duty?
Huh?
Is this during your
yeah,
guard duty?
Guard then? Duty or during there were quite a few instances when we would be roused out of bed in the wee hours in the morning because somebody thought we were going to be attacked. We never were. But on guard duty, we had every other day. You stood 6 hours of guard duty every other night. Either you had two shifts, either from 6 to 9 and 12 to 3, or from 9 to 12 and 3 to 6, and mm-hmm. you'd sleep when you could. And, of course, you had to go to work the next day.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun.
Yeah,
and sure. there were quite a, I guess, I don't know, quite a few times, four or five times, I guess, overall, that I know that somebody was shooting at me because I could hear the bullets pinging off of something hitting the sandbags or whizzing through the grass or hitting some building behind me there.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were sitting up on top of the berm in a folding chair, so we were a pretty good target. But I don't think anybody was ever trying to kill me specifically, mm-hmm. although they were shooting in my direction a couple times.
What would you do on guard duty? What was a typical guard duty?
Just sit and listen. We had these night vision binoculars that came in handy. We just sit up there and scan the area. And several positions around the compound there. Just keep your eyes open, you know, nothing major. There'd be an officer that would walk around every hour or so. And anything going on? No, sir. You know, keep your eyes open. And that's all we did. We just kept our eyes open and watched for rats and swatted mosquitoes and tried to stay awake, which is when it's really hot and humid and raining like crazy during the rainy season. That's not a lot of fun. We mainly sit up on top behind the sandbag berm or barrier. If we had to get inside a bunker, that was a lot of fun because they were always full of water and various creatures, and had to look at this little slit. Couldn't see much up there. It was hot and stifling, so we normally sit up on top. And that was easily the most tedious part of my whole time is guard duty.
Did you ever get wounded?
No.
At all?
No.
Okay.
No, we're close. Came close a couple of times, a couple of incidents, but I got lucky.
Okay. You mentioned little creatures. What kind of wild animals did you run into over there?
Well, turkey-sized mosquitoes, large rats, geckos, a variety of small snakes, some lizards, nothing crucial. And there were a few monkeys running around in a lot of the towns nearby, but no tigers or rhinoceroses or anything like that.
Right. Did you guys ever adopt any pets for your unit?
No, I didn't have the inclination to do that.
Okay.
No dogs, no cats, no nothing.
How much contact did you have with American combat troops?
Infantry
troops?
Virtually none, except when we go out on a chopper to pick up prisoners from an American unit. It would depend. Sometimes if they couldn't get they didn't have a helicopter available because theirs were being used for transporting troops or medical evacuations.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we get called to go out and pick up prisoners from American troops, American units. Mainly in the Iron Triangle, north of Saigon Air, 101st Airborne operated a lot in there, and 25th Division further to the west, we sometimes have contact with them. But unless they came in, some of their officers and NCOs would come into our little unit to get information specifically, very little contact with other Americans.
Okay. Did you ever sense any tension between those who were out in the field and those who were back in the rear?
No. Everybody had a job to do. You know, the vast majority of troops in Vietnam weren't combat at all. You know, they were truck drivers and clerk typists and supply and this kind of stuff. You know, probably at least 80% of the troops there were not infantry.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody knew, everybody had a job to do. I'm sure there was griping about how come I'm living out here in a mud hole and you're back there in that nice French concrete hut, but I didn't hear any of it because everybody's in the same boat, ultimately. Everybody runs a risk, although some guys obviously had more risky lives than others.
Mm-hmm.
But we're all on the same team.
Right. How often would you go out in the field? Would it be every other day or so?
Oh, it varied. Sometimes there'd be a lot of, during the rainy season, not as often as during the dry season, because things, during the rainy season, it rains a lot. You can't get anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It varied. Sometimes there'd be a lot of enemy activity and a lot of prisoners to be picked up, captured documents to look at, whatever. And other times, now, there was no real regimen to it.
Okay.
Sometimes every other day, sometimes every other week. It varied.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about your contact with, before I talk about the South Vietnamese forces, you mentioned there were some ROK troops there.
Just a few Korean troops in our area. Most of them were majors and captains.
What was your impression of them?
Oh, man, I wouldn't want to mess with those guys. They were serious. Mm-hmm. And there were quite a few Korean units in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And the North Vietnamese made every effort to avoid them, as far as we knew. They did not want anything to do with the South Koreans because they were pretty mean characters. They meant business. The South mm-hmm. Vietnamese could sometimes just be bought off, you know, look the other way.
Mm-hmm.
But the Koreans, they had their own up close and personal experience with communist troops, and the North Vietnamese would tend to avoid them. Plus, the Koreans, being fellow Asians,
mm-hmm.
could read signs and notice things and that we couldn't, and so the North Vietnamese, at least was my impression, wanted nothing to do with the South Koreans.
Okay. Well, what was your impression of the South Vietnamese troops?
Well, just the ones that, again, I had limited contact with them.
Mm-hmm.
The reconnaissance platoon that we had, those guys were absolutely fearless, and they suffered a lot of casualties. They spent a lot of time out at night. The two South Vietnamese sergeants that I worked with, Sergeant Vo and Sergeant Nguyen, very well trained, courageous. They both had families back in Saigon. They knew their country was at stake here. They had no illusions about what would happen to their country if the communists won. The other troops that I worked with at the interrogation center, they were part of the G2. They were very disciplined, very, very competent. The soldiers, the grunts, like me, the enlisted men, they seem to be pretty competent and very dedicated. They're non-commissioned officers, at least the ones I had contact with, seem to be very competent too, very,
mm-hmm.
very purposeful and serious. The officers, they tended to be a little bit better educated, and too often I got the impression their attitude was, what can this do for me? What can I scam here? What can mm-hmm. I get from the Americans, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They tended to wear a lot of medals, and they love to wear fancy watches, and they had a pocket full of fancy pins in their pockets and this kind of stuff, and they like to get stuff and have people do stuff for them, and
mm-hmm.
they at least some of the officers that I had to work with, they tended to be, you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I hit a button by mistake. They tended to be somewhat mercenary in my regard. Many of them, not all of them. The Vietnamese major that was in charge of the G2 section there, he got wounded several times doing things that he had no business doing, but he did them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And several of the officers, the lieutenants in the G2 section, the Vietnamese G2 section, they were pretty fearless. A couple of them got killed.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that higher up the food chain you went in the South Vietnamese Army, it seemed that the less competent a lot of people were, much like our own army.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of Vietnamese colonels and generals that would drop by from time to time, and they would have several jeeps, and they'd have these fancy uniforms on with gold braid and whatnot, and a whole retinue, kind of like a rock star would today. Kind of a lot of groupies hanging on them, you know, and opening mm-hmm. doors for them if there was somebody really important.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this would tend to set them apart from the ordinary soldier. Didn't inspire a lot of confidence. I saw that a couple of times. I wasn't too pleased with it, but
mm-hmm.
I did get that impression that a lot of the Vietnamese officers, not a lot, a substantial number, though, proportion, were out to get what they could
mm-hmm.
out of this situation and make the best of it.
Well, the reputation of the ARVN varies depending on who you talk to.
Yeah.
And you're given an impression that they were pretty competent.
At least in our area. During the Tet Offensive, one of the regiments got in just a horrific battle. I mean, you know, the Tet Offensive, half the ARVN guys were home on leave
mm-hmm.
because the communists said, we're not going to fight. Let's have a truce. Of course, they lied through their teeth, and they got slaughtered as a result of it.
Mm-hmm.
Tough on them.
Mm-hmm.
But during the Battle of An Loc, which is up north in Binh Long province, during the Tet Offensive, one of our regiments was pinned down there for several days. And they were already about half strength. And they fought, they just, it was incredible what I read about it after the battle and what we found out about it after the battle from different reports. That these Vietnamese just, they would not quit. They would not retreat. And they were heavily outnumbered. They said, we're going to hold on here till we get reinforcements. And they just fought like crazy for several days up there at An Lạc before they got relieved. And stuff like that, you know, it never seems to get in the paper. Heroic South Vietnamese unit holds on in face of overwhelming odds. You never saw that headline.
Right.
You never saw that. And but all over the country, and during the Tet Offensive in particular, most of the South Vietnamese units were, the urban units were at very low strength.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't recall any evidence of any of them quitting and running and buckling. They all fought like savages during that time. But that somehow never seems, it didn't fit the media stereotype. You know, the South Vietnamese are unmotivated and lazy, and I'm sure many of them were, because many of them were just illiterate peasants. Here's a gun, son, get out there. But the ones that I had contact with, and the ones that many that I read about, and I had information that, you know, even Time and Newsweek didn't have. They acquitted themselves well in so many battles and so many engagements, and they never really got the credit for it. And even to this day, that's too bad. Last year at my school, I have a English language development class, and I had a teacher's aide who was Vietnamese. He's about 60, and he was in the Army, Mr. Nguyen. And he told me some of his when he found out I had been in Vietnam, boy, he lit up. We did a lot of talking about what we had done. He had been south of Saigon, down in the Delta area for most of his tour in the Army, and he talked about a lot of the battles he had been in and the friends that he had lost. And it was obvious that his unit, whatever it was, you know, fought as well as they could and under pretty good odds. And these people never get the recognition that they do. So a lot of them had poor leadership and poor supplies and poor intelligence, and sometimes they were just simply outgunned and outmanned by the NVA. But a lot of them just never got the credit they deserve for being good soldiers.
Do you know what ever happened to Sergeant Vo and Sergeant Nguyen?
Haven't got a clue. I wrote to Sergeant Vo for probably 6 or 8 months after I got home. And Sergeant Nguyen, Trent Van Nguyen, he got transferred to someplace else, so even Sergeant Vo lost touch with him. So, but after about, I don't know, 6 or 8 months of writing letters to Sergeant Vo and him writing to me, he just stopped. And I sent a few more letters but never got anything back. So I don't know if he got killed or sent to re-education camp eventually, but that was in the 60s. So I really don't know what happened to him after that. Maybe he just lost interest in me or whatever, but never had a clue.
Okay. How did you experience the Tet Offensive?
Well, got up one morning, and we were told that North Vietnamese and VC were attacking all over the country, and we put on extra guards, and we didn't get any sleep for about 4 days, and we had a lot of interrogations of captured prisoners over at 1st Air Cav and in our own unit, and down at the National Police. Our movements at night were very limited. Even though we did have to do some driving at night, that was always fun. And we had that big battle right outside of our wire. I was in Phu Quoc City, about 4 miles to the west, the provincial capital. And there was a lot of action on the other side of the river, with jets coming in and dropping napalm. Our Recondo platoon had their barracks were about a kilometer south of our unit, and they got attacked. And we spent every night out in our bunkers or down at the IPW center. We didn't sleep hardly at all for 4 days. We just kind of catnapped when we could. We heard it was a very scary situation too, because we get reports coming in from all over the country about, we heard about the butchery up in Hue, and that the American embassy had been attacked in Saigon, and there were North Vietnamese tanks coming into Saigon and this kind of stuff. And you know, are we going to be cut off? But after a few days, things subsided pretty quickly, and it became pretty apparent over the next few days as we got reports in from around the country that the communists had just suffered overwhelming losses everywhere they went. Eventually, they had a lot of success further north, especially around the city of Hue, where they massacred several thousand people. And I didn't hear a peep out of Jane Fonda about that. Still haven't. So, but it was an intense time, even though there was limited, except for that little battle right outside of our Y. We weren't involved in that one. It was the 273rd. It was just an Air Force thing, basically. They just came in and bombed the heck out of them. So in terms of combat and being attacked, we made it through pretty much unscathed. Although we did get a few mortar shells and a couple 122-millimeter rocket rounds came in. Don't know if they were shooting at us or just missed their target. So it was a tense time, however.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
It was, because it was just so uncertain. You know, it's not like France in World War II. We're here, they're there. That was the uncertainty of it the whole time. When you're driving down the road in the Jeep doing something, the guy walking down the road in front of you carrying a water bucket, is he who he seems to be? You don't know.
Right.
And it's just that constant apprehension. It's kind of, I guess you call it free-floating anxiety in psychological terms, that you still remember. But Tet was a lot of fun. But after Tet, in the weeks and months after, as we kept, we weren't cut off out there. We had these things called newspapers and magazines and Armed Forces television, which didn't work hardly at all, but it became apparent after Tet that somebody's got this wrong, you know. There's a lot of dead communists out there, and nobody is talking about that. They're talking about the communists' ability to coordinate an attack throughout the country. Well, my God, telephones and radios can work wonders. But somebody got that awfully wrong, and as far as I'm concerned, still do. It was a horrible defeat for the communists. But since we'd made a big point of saying, hey, we got this thing under control, you know, we're on the way to victory, light at the end of the tunnel and all that, and then this happens, you know, people can say, wait a minute, I thought those guys were on the run. Well, they are. There's a lot more of them dead now than there were before, but I think the media just totally blew that one, and I think that was the beginning of the end for our involvement there, that after all this time, that the enemy can still mount a coordinated attack like that, and... and die like flies as a result, but somehow that just shook the confidence in our military back home that there's not going to be any end to this. And I think that was the beginning of the end in terms of our resolve, let's not fight to win, let's just fight to somehow get an armistice and have a peace treaty. And once you say that, once you say we're not fighting to win, then you lose. Because North Vietnamese had one of their top leaders who went by the pseudonym of Chuong Chin, which means March to Victory. He'd written a book about how we're going to win the war.
Right.
And it's very, very simple. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to fight, talk, 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 and the Americans can't understand that, and we're eventually going to win the war. And that's exactly what happened.
So. Did you see any drop-off in the number of VC coming in, say, the three or four months after Tet?
Yeah. As far as I recall, not a heck of a lot happened, as far as I recall. The few months after that, it was mainly some mopping up activity. The North Vietnamese had to retreat back into Cambodia and Laos and further north to resupply and replace their dead guys. And the VC, I don't really know how the VC fared in the Tet Offensive. I know they carried out a lot of small sapper attacks and terroristic type attacks during that time, and even some larger scale military operations, especially around Saigon. But as far as I recall, in a long time, that there was kind of a lull after that in terms of their activity.
Right. Okay, we're going to take a break for today and pick up this interview up a little bit later. Thank you very much, sir.